Welcome back, everyone, to Commerce Experience. I'm your host, Brian Walker, Chief Strategy Officer at Bloomreach. Today, we're talking about how brands should think differently about performance marketing, the KPIs they should focus on, especially as we face a potential economic downturn. And we'll also talk about the content and media strategies brands and businesses should think about as they execute their marketing. Joining me today is Joe Yacuel, founder and CEO at Within, a performance marketing agency based in New York that helps consumer brands scale through media and content across all their digital marketing platforms. Enjoy the show. Joe, thanks so much for joining us here today. I want to start with the first question we ask every guest here on the podcast. What was your first role or job that dealt with e-commerce or digital?
Thanks for having me, Brian. Great to be here. And my first job that touched digital and e-com was actually working with my brother, Ron. And my brother, Ron, owns and operates Perfume.com and FragranceX.com. And he's about 10 years older than me and always looked up to him in terms of what he's been able to do as an entrepreneur. And he was definitely my entry point into e-com and digital. And given that he is older than me and he's had this business for a while, it allowed me to start to play around with digital marketing and e-commerce. It's kind of toward the end of high school and certainly during college. And that's kind of what got me my start into understanding the world of e-com and digital and where I'd play in it.
What a great way to get started. What time frame are we talking about?
I'm 34. Actually, I just turned 35. I should have to start realizing.
Happy birthday.
10 days ago. Yeah, thank you. So I'm 35. And I guess we're talking like, when I was probably 16, 17, 18, when this started really being something that I was kind of playing around with my brother. And then I interned with him a little bit after college, which kind of led me to some of my first e-commerce startups.
Very, very cool. As I said, what a great way to get started. So Joe, first kind of guess real question here is, your agency Within bills itself as a performance branding agency. Can you explain a bit about what you see as different from other creative and marketing agencies and kind of what that means to you?
And I think the word agency, for many reasons, both legitimate and not legitimate, has become kind of like a dirty word in marketing. And I think there's some, like I said, some valid reasons for that and some not so valid. But, we like to think about ourselves as a performance branding company. And we very intentionally dropped the word agency because it has some kind of mixed connotations to it, a lot of which speak to the idea that agencies operate like vendors rather than partners. And that's something that we really care deeply about is operating like a true business partner, which is a good segue to answering your question around like, what does it really mean to be a performance branding company? And how is that different from a typical marketing agency, whether it be media or creative? And I think the highest level answer to that is that performance branding is a marketing methodology that we use that allows us to align the marketing program back to the business objective. And that's really the most critical thing here, is that all businesses do marketing for the same reason. And businesses do marketing to make money, right? There's really no other reason why businesses do marketing. There's many metrics that they use that allow them to measure that tie it back to money at some later date. And maybe they're not tying it back to money as the first KPI in the immediate term. But in the end of the day, if businesses didn't believe marketing made money, they wouldn't do it. But for some reason, most marketing programs, not some, but almost all of them, for some reason, don't actually align back to the business objective. They have their own marketing objective that is somehow disassociated with the actual business objective. Simple example, which you'll see all the time. Business wants to drive long-term profit. Marketing wants to drive short-term revenue. Not the same thing, not aligned at all, right? So that's, I would say, like the highest level differentiator that we are ruthless about, which is constantly ensuring that every single thing that we do in marketing makes sense and aligns back to the business objective. And sometimes the business objective is not long-term profit. Sometimes it is something else, but oftentimes it is long-term profit. And we want marketing to speak to that. And if I were to add one other thing that allows us to do that well, it's really breaking down silos. And silos exist everywhere in marketing. Silos exist between media and creative in the first place. Silos exist between marketing channels. silos exist between performance marketing and brand marketing. And we believe all of those silos are just more obstacles that prevent marketers and marketing from aligning back to the business objective in the purest form that we want to really solve for and break down those silos to achieve it.
Yeah, I what you just kind of went through very much resonates with me, and I'm sure it'll resonate with a lot of people listening. And there are many cases kind of long-standing challenges that if you've worked in marketing or e-commerce for a long period of time, you've probably seen multiple iterations of, right? So I guess kind of a follow-on question there would be breaking down silos. What are some of the ways you've seen that be successful? What are some techniques, tools, concepts that help drive that change?
Yeah, I think org structure is a massive part of that. I think it is very difficult to create a truly integrated marketing team, process, methodology, program, whatever you want to call it, when people are individually siloed as a job function and further siloed by success metrics that tie to their specific function as a silo in the first place. And when I look at some of the places where, you know, we've broken the mold and I think has fueled our ability to accomplish this successfully, it's really around breaking down those silos inside the job function itself. So for example, typical agencies have very specific roles and responsibilities, from ad trafficking to media buying, to planning, to strategy, to analytics and reporting. And each of these are broken up further by channel. And again, further by brand versus performance, where we collapse all of that into a single team, where people operate much more fluidly across all of those different aspects. And the same person who might assist with planning a campaign can also assist with traffic a campaign, executing a campaign, reporting on a campaign, and can also do that across multiple channels. Yes, it's a lot harder to do training and development to make those people capable of accomplishing those types of tasks in that fluid manner. But if you invest heavily in training and development, which we certainly have, it pays massive dividends in the ability of people to understand the full picture and operate according to that full picture for the business. And I think that is the single most impactful thing that we've found allows us to actually collapse the silos in practice versus just talk about collapsing those silos. Because you could talk about it all you want, but if everyone goes back to their desk and operates in a silo, it doesn't matter how much you talk about it.
Absolutely. That really makes sense to me. And I can envision, as you start to engage a new client, you need to start talking about then how they're going to organize around the work that you're going to help them drive. And I would imagine that's a business transformation that kind of bleeds into consulting in many ways. So that's kind of a difference maker I could envision.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's exactly right. It's sometimes a bit jarring, especially for new clients, when they see an org chart and they don't see like the very typical titles and silos built into it. And then they kind of look back to the pitch process and understand that a lot of what they bought in the pitch has to actually come to life in the org structure, even if it is very different than what they're used to. But it allows us to put up much bigger returns, because there's also no infighting for credit, right? The search team isn't trying to take credit for something the social team is trying to take credit for, to justify their budget, to justify their success metrics. And it allows us, in the most simplest of examples, to move money with no ego and no conflict of interest from one channel to another in real time, because everyone on the team is gold off to the same thing, which is client NPS, right? Not budget under management in a specific channel or silo.
Right. Again, that makes a lot of sense. So shifting gears a little bit, I think, you know, we're talking at kind of an interesting time. We're in the fall now, and obviously there's a lot of kind of turbulence in the sort of economic news cycle, and we're heading into holiday. There's a lot of speculation as to what, you know, consumer behavior will look like this holiday season, what share of wallet and spending will look like between services and products, and you know, the impact of what is essentially record low consumer confidence as we head into the holidays. And I think a lot of, you know, business leaders out there in some respects believe that a recession may in fact be inevitable. And we're not here to necessarily debate whether that's true or not. But I guess what I'm interested in is, as you work with clients, how are they thinking about adjusting their marketing strategies, their KPIs? What do you think businesses should be thinking about, both kind of strategically and tactically, as we move into potentially a downturn or a challenging economic period?
I think a lot of brands are talking about cutting costs right now. And I think every investor and every startup is getting pressure around the same thing, around making sure that all the businesses that they're investing in, or on the flip side, the businesses that they're operating, are being really conservative with their financial outlay and being profitable as much as possible or as soon as possible. And if you think about that and juxtapose that against how CFOs operate when they're tasked with the very same thing, right? CFOs look at expenses to cut, right? And one of the biggest line item in the expense line is going to be marketing. Now, with no other context, you would think reduce that, improve cash flow, improve profitability. Very simple, right? How can we reduce that as close to zero as possible, in theory, is better for the business in terms of short-term cash flow and profitability. But that's actually not how performance marketing at least works. Maybe some parts of brand marketing work that way in the short term, but even that won't be true in the long term. But for performance marketing, even in the short term, depending on how much that business is spending and how what the ROI is on that spend, it's possible that reducing the marketing quote unquote expense actually reduces the cash flow and profitability for that business in the immediate term. So we like to think about this spectrum in terms of where businesses are relative to first order profit and LTV. And basically, if your current marketing investment is better than first order profit, where you actually have the ability to spend an additional incremental dollar, and that incremental dollar you're going to go and spend over and above your existing budget is also going to be profitable on the first order, then you're not spending enough. And actually cutting spend is going to reduce your profit and reduce your cash flow. So the first kind of like baseline or benchmark that we want CFOs and marketers to align on is, where are they on that spectrum today? Are you already spending money that is unprofitable on the first order or not? Now, if not, meaning you have, if you have more money you can spend and you could still make it first order profitable on that incremental budget, you should spend it all day, every day until you hit that point. Meaning, there is no discussion about cutting budget. Actually, the discussion is about increasing budget until you reach the point where you can no longer spend incremental dollars at least first order profitably. Then it starts to become a judgment call and a business discussion around, are we willing to invest beyond first order profit or not? That's where lifetime value comes into question. What is the difference between first order profit and 12-month lifetime value or 24-month lifetime value? Do we have enough cash runway to invest beyond first order profit or not? And if we do, how much, right? Can we invest based on 12-month LTV, 24-month LTV, or somewhere in between, right? But that's kind of where we want the conversation to start. Because if you don't start the conversation there, it really is just a matter of talking about cutting marketing as if it's cutting expenses like office supplies, right? Which doesn't take into account the fact that the marketing dollars being spent, again, at least in the performance marketing world, have direct implication to not only revenue, but profitability. So this whole idea of first order profit as a KPI is something that always comes up and something that we push very heavily on whenever there's challenging economic times. So this is something that we talked a lot about right when COVID happened, right? Everybody was hunkering down, cutting spend, and we were having these conversations endlessly around like, okay, let's talk about cutting spend, but don't cut beyond first order profit. But it also becomes an optimization metric, meaning it's not just a point in a line in the sand of where you draw the line of budget, but it's also a matter of how you optimize that budget. If you're currently optimizing to ROAS, then, and you care a lot about cash flow in the immediate term or profit in the immediate term, stop optimizing to revenue or customer acquisition and start optimizing to profitability. Because where you are against first order profit can also change if you optimize for it or not. And if you're currently not first order profitable, but you're optimizing ROAS, optimizing to profitability can make you first order profitable, potentially on the same budget.
Makes a lot of sense. So one question as we drill into this concept of first order profit, does that change like the promotional strategy, even the products the customer may be thinking about pushing, as well as channels and marketing spend within those channels and kind of the campaign strategy? Like, to what degree are you kind of incorporating multiple variables and trying to optimize for first order profit?
Yeah. So for first order profit, the most important thing is going to be, you know, the margin dollars on any given item, right? And obviously the basket that people build. Now,
so for example, just to stop you. So for example, pushing a full price item that is not on sale, where you're already carving into the margin. So you might say, well, I'm going to lean on, you know, new product or product that is not being discounted. And I might not necessarily acquire customers as quickly through that tactic, but I'm definitely more profitable.
Yeah, actually, the easiest way to think about that is through the lens of an advertiser who's currently optimizing to ROAS. So if you're currently optimizing to ROAS, and then you compare that to first order profit and ask yourself basically the same question you just asked, Brian, which is like, well, what's going to change if I make this shift? Well, when you're optimizing to ROAS, if you're trying to get the same ROAS all the time, then where you're losing profit, to your point, Brian, is between sale and non-sale, between categories of product that have different margin rates, or even between the differences in how people build basket, right, based on who they are or what channel they come from, right? If you're thinking about it in terms of willingness to pay for traffic before it even hits the site, right? So those are the things that are going to drive the biggest differences between a ROAS-driven strategy and a first order profit-driven strategy. So if you want to think about it again through that lens of ROAS, we're going to say, well, hey, if you're going to go and run a sale, you better get a much better ROAS than when you're not running a sale. Hey, if you're selling a low margin item, you better get a much better ROAS than when you're selling a high margin item. But one way that you could simplify all this is to just strip ROAS out of the equation and just go straight to first order profit. And if you pass that data back to your bidding platforms, right, then you can literally tell the platforms to optimize to it in real time, leveraging their algorithms, instead of trying to back into the right ROAS for different products, different categories, or different seasonality and promotional time periods, which is both more complicated and cumbersome, but also less effective in achieving the end goal.
Very interesting. I also love this, you know, question around first order profit versus measuring the effectiveness of your marketing against lifetime value. And I guess I'm interested in kind of exploring the tension between those two concepts. Do you think that they, in a sense, are a binary, that they kind of are represent completely different strategies and kind of sets of goals? Or do you think they're complementary, you know, in the end? And how should a marketer think about driving a first order profit, you know, strategy, which may be really critical in the short term, and then still thinking about growing a business based on customer retention and reactivation and lifetime value?
Yeah, so we see first order profit as basically being the entry point to lifetime value. If you're risk averse and you don't want to take into account any future repeat purchases, then optimizing to first order profit is going to be a safer play because you're basically assuming that nobody will ever repeat. Right. Now, the downside of that is if you take an example, let's take me and Brian and I both purchased the exact same item from the same retailer at the same price. First order profit's going to look at the two of us and say we're exactly the same. But let's just say that, Brian, I'll make some stuff up about you. But let's just say that you live, let's say that you have three kids and you live in the suburbs and you make, you know, since you're clearly killing it here, you're making, you know, a couple million bucks a year. Right. And I'm making $100,000 a year and I live in the city and I'm single, right? Those things might, depending on the business, obviously, might be major predictors around repeat rate. And me and you came in and bought the same item, but I bought it as a gift for my friend and you bought it for yourself and you're predicted to repeat 5 times a year and I'm likely to repeat 0. First order profit's going to go after people like me and you the same, with the same willingness to pay, which is going to determine the mix of customers you get. But if we took into account the predicted repeat rate and those different variables that I mentioned that we're going to assume for this conversation is highly predictive of lifetime value for that business, then it would be really silly to say that you're willing to pay the same amount for me and Brian, because you're actually willing to pay 5 times more for Brian than you are for me. And if you actually do that in your marketing program, you'll end up with a very different customer mix in that second example where you do take into account those predictive elements, because you'll end up with way more Brians and less Joes than in the first example, even if it means you acquired less customers overall. If you shift the mix enough to Brians versus Joes, you'll end up making a lot more money over time, right? So really the only difference between FOP and LTV is repeat rate. And by not taking into account repeat rate, then you're treating everyone the same, whether they're going to repeat or not, which we know is not good business. You're always going to be, you should be taking into account repeat rate into your willingness to pay. And if you are, you're going to change your customer mix accordingly, which is going to align, going back to performance branding, it's going to align marketing back to the business objective.
Yeah, and I think it ends up building a more sustainable long-term platform for your business, right? And you need to think about all the sets of tactics, not only post-customer acquisition, that are going to drive that repeat rate, drive customer loyalty, you know, build on a dialogue with the customer, right? Delivering context and some personalization to enable that in order to capture that. But I think it's really important. I love this idea of, like, you know, making sure that your marketing is tuned to first order profit, making sure that that's a way you can demonstrate the return to the business from, like, essentially the customers you're acquiring, but then building in, layering in these programs that enable you to then build a sustainable long-term business off of those customers you're acquiring. I think that's just common sense in many ways, but it does reflect, I think, a shift in mindset, even from just a year ago or a year and a half ago, where it seemed that we were still in a phase in the market where customer acquisition was king and it was all about market share and reach. Do you see it that way? Do you think we've kind of entered into a new phase in the market where some of these concepts we're talking about are more important? Or do you think that's just the narrative that's being applied to it?
Yeah, I would say, like, when you're dealing with earlier stage companies, it's very different than later stage ones. Another way of saying, the investor kind of appetite for risk is going to drive whether or not the KPIs make sense, right? And sometimes what you see in startup land is very different than what you see in public markets, but sometimes they're the same. And when the market is telling people that they value revenue growth over anything else, that optimizing to revenue makes a lot of sense. If people are punished for revenue that doesn't drive profit and rewarded for running compounding profit streams, right? Another way of saying an LTV strategy, right? Where they can see in the economics of your business that maybe you're not acquiring the most insane growth rate of new customers or revenue, but you are acquiring revenue profitably, and that profitability continues to compound based on a strong repeat rate, and that gets rewarded, then that, again, ties back to the right KPIs that businesses should be using. But if you're an early stage business and you're rewarded for short-term revenue growth, and optimizing for short-term revenue kind of makes sense, right? Until it doesn't. So I think if you were to ask this through the lens of, like, hey, over a really long time period, like, is this just the same stuff that should have always been true? I would say, yeah, right? But a lot of times businesses are operating under shorter time horizons based on investor kind of criteria and rounds of funding, where they really are optimizing to the next round more so than they are optimizing to the 10-year longevity of the business. And again, sometimes that does make business sense, right? Sometimes it doesn't. It depends on where you are in your life cycle, how much money you're raising, and whether you're going to raise them again shortly after that, and against what assumptions.
Well, so I think what it makes sense if that's the framework in which you, like, acquired equity and investment into your business, then you have to deliver on that. But you could argue maybe that was in some cases flawed from the beginning.
Yeah, well, the other thing is, like, think about what you're compounding, right? Like, because with an LTV driven strategy, by definition, you're compounding profit, but you're also compounding revenue. So even if revenue is something that investors are chasing for your business, right, then a ROAS-driven strategy, while it's great for revenue today, actually does not help you with revenue tomorrow at all. It is literally not taken into account in the KPI in any way.
Absolutely.
But LTV, it takes into account long-term profit, but profit comes from revenue. So future revenue is baked into LTV, which every day that you run an LTV strategy makes profit easier tomorrow, but also makes revenue easier tomorrow, which is why the time horizon here is so critical when thinking about the right KPI for your business.
I personally view that the concepts you're talking about and that we're discussing here, those are the pragmatic kind of baseline strategies that were critical, basically, and it's just grounded in common sense, you know, forever. But I think in many cases in the market kind of lost the thread in the last, say, 5-10 years, and now we're kind of getting back to first principles. And I think that's a healthy thing. And hopefully enables businesses to make a transition in their marketing mix and strategies that is long-term sustainable and potentially even changes the way in which the investor community who's investing in growth brands looks at the fundamentals and kind of shifts that mindset. I think COVID kind of threw off the signal, in other words.
Yeah, and I think people also have like some misconceptions about the flexibility around LTV. Right? Like some people think it means you have to spend more money. Not true, right? You could shift from a ROAS strategy to an LTV strategy on the same budget or even less budget. It's a KPI. It doesn't mean spend up to your LTV. It just means LTV is the thing that differentiates how much you're willing to pay to acquire one customer versus another based on the difference in their value over time. That's a big misconception. The other big misconception is that you can't be conservative with LTV, meaning you can calc an LTV and use a net present value to adjust it back with a really high cost of capital. Meaning you can say, hey, I'm going to discount the year two and year three values by 20% a year, right? And that obviously builds kind of conservatism into the model. And then the other thing is that to be more conservative, you should use a shorter LTV window, which is, again, not true. That is one way to look at it, but actually that in a lot of ways defeats the purpose of LTV, meaning the biggest purpose of LTV is to differentiate the value from one customer to another. And if you think about the difference between first order profit and, let's use an extreme example, 5-year LTV, the difference is that first order profit only looks at the first transaction. 5-year LTV looks at every transaction over 5 years. If you shorten the 5-year LTV to a 3-month LTV, you're basically just looking at first order profit again. Right? Yeah. You want to see the deviation and variation from one cohort to another. I much rather see a brand have an insanely high cost of capital, net present value tied to their LTV, but use a much longer LTV time horizon than use no NPV and no cost of capital and use a much shorter time horizon, because the shorter time horizon will just make everyone look more similar to each other. The wider time horizon will make everyone look more different to each other, and you could still discount those back heavily. But the key to LTV is differentiating the value from customers. If they all look the same on LTV, you're basically just using first order profit.
Yeah, that makes sense. So I want to shift gears a little bit and talk about media versus creative. And I know that you kind of have a point of view on how many businesses look at those two aspects of their marketing strategy. And in some cases, like think of creative as a cost of doing business and might even like minimize it. I'd love to kind of get your thoughts on media versus creative and how you think businesses should shift their mindset around those key fundamentals.
If you roll back the clock to this being a search only world, right? Creative didn't really matter. And then you have social come onto the scene and creative matters, but it's like still imagery. Right. And then it was like, add a little motion. It doesn't even matter what. It can be a GIF. It can be a motion graphic. Just like make it move and it's better. Right. And now like customers are expecting like real video. Right. Like it's like the fake it hacks. Sometimes they could work. I'm not going to say they never work. But like people now want to see real true form video in their ad experiences. So if you think about that, right, and then you think about what we know about paid social at a minimum, right, which is these platforms want an insane amount of content. They want a high variety of content. Why do they want so much volume and so much variety? Because they want to serve the right user, the right ad at the right time. Go figure, right? That's nothing new. That was true 20 years ago also. The difference is that 20 years ago, you were doing that with text, and now you're doing it with video. Right. And it was really easy to just spit out a bunch of different text variations and A/B test them or let the platform choose it. Right. But it's a lot more complicated or more expensive or both when you want to do the same type of volume and variety or permutation with video, because video is more expensive to create than text. Right. So if you think about all that, and then you go back to the where we started the conversation of all of these things being looked at as an expense, one overly simplistic way that people look at marketing expense versus creative expense is, well, yeah, we need some sort of creative to run the ad, but the real value is in the media. So again, let's minimize the expense on creative. We just need something to run, but let's try to get that as close to zero as possible. And then let's put all the money into running that thing, because that's what really makes the money, is running the media and getting the eyeballs, right? Which of course, like, we understand why that concept exists, right? Like, if you don't serve it to anybody, that's also not gonna bode well, right? If nobody sees the ad. But we know that there's a tremendous amount of value to be unlocked based on serving the right ad to the right person at the right time. So therefore, if we give the media the wrong creative, or we only give it one piece of creative, then the media doesn't have the ability to differentiate the right ad for the right person at the right time. And it's forced to use a blunt instrument, which does not perform as well. Which is why if you go back to this idea of just like money being fungible, right? It doesn't really matter where the money goes, as long as we get the best ROI. Who really cares if it's 90% media, 10% creative, or 60% media and 40% creative, or something else? If I could tell you that you'll get a better ROI by shifting that ratio, would you tell me that you don't want to do it under the premise of you don't like the ratio, right? Like, I don't think anyone really cares about the ratio. They care about the outcome. And what we find is that brands who are willing to invest more in creative to generate more volume and more variety will end up with a better outcome, even if that money comes out of media. And that is a testable proposition, where you can literally do this with math, with A/B testing, to see, hey, if I were to only produce one thing, what would I have produced? Let me run media behind it, assuming that the creative cost is very low. And then if I were to peel more out of media and put it into creative, what else would I have made? Let me run that with less media dollars, because I need to use it to fund the creative, and run them against each other, right? And we've done this many times. And basically we find that, of course, there's a point of diminishing returns, but most brands aren't even close to reaching that and are well underinvested in creative relative to their media investment. And we want to see more and more brands be willing to pull money out of media and put it into creative to figure out the incremental return they can get there. But the delta between what we find to be optimal and what brands are producing is so wide. So brands on average, we find for paid social, are producing like 5 videos a month. What we want to see brands have is about 100 videos a month. Now, not all those videos need to come from the brand or from the brand's creative agency, right? We're talking about the totality of volume and variety of content here, not where it comes from. You could get 10 videos a month made internally, 15 videos a month made by the creative agency, you know, 15 videos a month from influencers, 15 videos a month from your customers, right? And get the rest from like content creators, which is what we call them. And all of that together can add up to 100 videos a month, for example. So I think brands need to widen the lens around where video can come from. And part of that, I think, also is a requirement that brands think about their brand guidelines differently.
Because right, I was going to ask about that.
Yeah, if all of your content creation has to run through the same filter, regardless of the method of creation, nothing ever gets approved. And I think brands need to realize that consumers are very savvy today, and they know when your content is supposed to look like branded content, and they know when the content they're looking at isn't and is obviously made by a content creator, is some form of UGC or influencer content, etc. And therefore, it does not need to live up to the same brand guidelines. So I think, summarize this, right? Like, brands need to be willing to invest in creative the same way they invest in media. They need to be willing to move that toggle over and test where that diminishing return really starts to hit. And most brands are nowhere near it today. And level set on the type of volume and variety that these platforms want, which is more of that like 100 videos a month scale versus where they are today, which is like 5. And figure out what the big levers they can pull to get there and what they need to change in their brand guidelines to let those things get approved. And we really push brands to have 2 sets of guidelines: brand guidelines when they make stuff, and creator guidelines when it's obvious to the consumer that it wasn't made by the brand. And those guidelines need to be a lot looser, which allows for the authenticity to happen. If you make those guidelines so strict, the authenticity goes away and the whole point of the volume and variety goes away with it.
How do you advise a marketer who comes from maybe a more traditional brand marketing mindset on kind of freeing that up and letting some of that control go? And I can imagine that's even an issue in the C-suite of many organizations who like get uncomfortable when they see humor or they see sarcasm or they see, you know, what some of the influencers or creatives out there would do around a product, right? You know, whether it's making fun of the name of the product or saying it wrong or all these different kinds of things that can actually lead to a viral moment and even enable some of this content to really scale. How do you advise a marketer around that?
I would say there's always going to be hard lines, right? And I get that. And you should figure out what those non-negotiables are, and that should apply across the board. I think there's a huge difference between the obvious like hard lines and like the nice to haves, right? Or like the preferences. And I think those are the kinds of things that are okay in brand guidelines, but not okay in creator guidelines. Even in brand guidelines, if it's too narrow, you're basically saying there's no room for testing. So one reason that I think brands can be less like nervous or careful about these things is that if you're doing your testing right and your content optimization right, the only things that get scale anyway are things that perform. So if something is making you nervous, and part of what's making you nervous is that it won't work, then don't worry about it, because if it doesn't work, no one will see it.
Well, what if they're nervous about it working in the wrong way?
And then if they're nervous about it working, right, then my point is, well, that's a good problem to have. Test it, and if it works and you'd like to see it done a bit differently, then run a new variation against it. Hey, this thing crushed it, but I don't love that Brian said XYZ. Great, let's create a new variation where Brian doesn't say XYZ and see if it works as well. And if it works just as well, we can kill the first one. If it doesn't, then you kind of have your answer about why that thing might not be that important, or maybe it is and you want to shut it down anyway, but at least you'll know the answer. But I always tell people, like, don't be too shy to test things because you're nervous it won't work or you're nervous it will. Figure out if it works or not, and then you can make a judgment call of whether you want to tweak it or change your direction. But you don't actually take that much risk, because if you're running this through performance, the only things that get scale are things that perform.
Good answer. I love it. Let's talk a little bit about channels, right? Channels just seem to keep proliferating, platforms that marketers need to be thinking about. I know this is a very kind of open-ended question, but how do you work with a new client to determine channel mix of their marketing and where they're putting their dollars and how to define at least a starting point for them and then start to test and optimize from there?
I think that especially post iOS 14.5, like, brands want to find the new Facebook, right? Like, okay, you know, the targeting doesn't work as well, or the CPMs are high. Like, I want to put those dollars to work the same way I did before somewhere else, right? And yes, TikTok is a real thing. It is clearly growing very quickly. It is going to be a major part, I think, of every brand's media mix. But it's still early days for the advertising platform side of that business to mature and drive the kind of ROI that brands expect. And the reality is, other than TikTok, there hasn't been a massive change in where you can put money to work at a good ROI, especially for performance, since iOS 14.5. Which really means you got to figure out a way to make Google and Meta work. Because if you can't make Google and Meta work, right, everything else is not going to replace your shortcomings, right? And I oftentimes see people running themselves astray by spending the majority of their time, money, and resources trying to make the other platforms in digital work, when they would have done much better by taking those resources, time, money, effort to make Google and Facebook work better. Meaning, if you don't like the way that the performance you're getting out of Google and Facebook, instead of shifting your focus to the other stuff, continue focusing on how to make that work better for you, because that's still where the scale is. Again, for ROI-driven performance marketers, the scale is still on Google and Facebook. And it's not like there's this other magical place you can go to get the same scale as Google and Facebook at a better return than Google and Facebook. right? And there's always going to be anomalies, and there's always going to be that one story of that one brand that did that one thing outside that worked really well. But again, for the most part, Google and Facebook are still where the majority of performance marketing dollars go in digital. And until TikTok kind of surpasses Google or Facebook in the media spend under management, there is no other place to go that will perform better than spending your time, money, and effort making those platforms work better. Now, again, that doesn't mean don't be anywhere else. It just means you have to be realistic about the kind of scale you're going to get everywhere else. So should you be on Pinterest, Snapchat, YouTube, TikTok? Absolutely, right? Should you be on programmatic? Absolutely. Should you test into podcasts and influencer marketing and be an affiliate? Absolutely. Again, depending on how big your budget is, all of those things are good places to be. But make sure that you're allocating your time, money, effort, and resources in a way that is logical relative to the potential scale of that platform. Even if it's not the current scale of your view on that platform, at least the potential scale of that platform, which is still going to show you that Google and Facebook have to be the place where you put the majority of your time, effort, and money to improve your performance, not the other way around.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, Joe. One thing that, you know, we're talking a lot about media and advertising here, but one kind of key issue that I think has been persistent in e-commerce and direct marketing for a very long time is the disconnect between the marketing and the experience you deliver once you get someone to engage, once you get someone to click through, once you've, and how to drive like conversion optimization and leverage the tools to drive context and personalization within that experience, but most importantly, consistency. I'd love to get your thoughts on that. Do you think that remains a key issue? And what are some of the ways that you advise clients to kind of address that and think about that?
Sorry, I'm not 100% following your question.
I'm just talking about the disconnect between the marketing that I as a consumer engage with and react to and the experience I get once I actually click through, once you've actually captured my interest. Often there's a massive disconnect, and there's been a persistent issue, and some of it's technology related and the tools that businesses are trying to leverage. It also, again, relates to the silos that we started the conversation kind of talking about. But how do you work with clients to kind of address that, understand that, and tackle that?
I think there is really kind of two equal sides to the coin here, the ad experience and the landing page experience. And I think, you know, we find that most people are obsessive over the ad experience and completely ignore the landing page experience, or otherwise just take it for granted. Like, well, that's the landing page, right? So like, how can we make more people come to it? And it's funny, I was reading this, I think it was like a LinkedIn post about somebody who has done tons of conversion rate optimization, A/B testing. And they were saying how like they've tested everything under the sun, buttons, colors, placement, like, you know, content, et cetera. And the person was saying that the by far number one biggest kind of needle mover for A/B testing that was also the most consistent over time is having the main headline of the ad copy be a main part of the headline of the landing page. Meaning literally just saying right. The same words from the ad on the page yeah. is actually going to drive a bigger conversion rate lift than virtually anything else you could test on that page, right? And like, when you think about that and you think about how much time and effort people put into the ads and how little effort they put into the landing page, that's just something that like immediately came to mind for me is like, something that I think every marketer needs to think harder about, which is, are you working equally as hard at converting people who are coming to your site based on the experience you give them on the landing page as you are trying to get them to that page in the first place? Because what's the point of spending all the money to drive the person to the page if the page experience sucks, right? And if you also think about it from an economics perspective, right, making the page experience better doesn't cost you anything, right? Of course, it can cost you time and materials, but like my point is, it's not like if you improve the performance of the landing page by 20%, you have to pay 20% more every time somebody lands there, right? But that is true in the ad experience, meaning you could do a great job of the ad experience. You're still going to have to pay every single time you want to serve that ad again, right? And I think this is something that this is a great example of the kinds of things that I think, to your point earlier about like the economy changing people's focus, I think this is a great example of where it's changing people's focus in the right way. That should always have been their focus in the past, which is not just the landing page experience, but I'll broaden it here a little bit to like all kind of first party owned and operated stuff, whether it be data, whether it be experience, right? Whether it be channels. So for example, we're seeing brands with a much bigger appetite to invest in improving everything first party because all the third party stuff is harder or more expensive. So that's SEO, that's email and SMS, that's on-site experience, it's page load time, right? It's content development, because all of those things help brands make money in a way that doesn't require them to spend more endlessly on the spigot to drive more eyeballs to the page. I think that's like a refreshing aspect of people's kind of inevitable view of the recession or poor consumer confidence that you mentioned in the beginning of our chat, that is driving brands in the right direction in a way that they should have always been focused, which is how can I make more out of the juice I already have versus making more juice?
Yeah, I think it's critical. I love the example of just even the text demonstrating to the customer that there's consistency, you know, between, oh, okay, I'm in the right place, right? I clicked through that ad or that social media post or what have you, and I'm in the right place. And I'm not in some generic environment where now it's the work's on me to go navigate to what I'm actually like interested in, what you captured my interest in. I think that's really critical for brands to think about context and then leveraging personalization tools in order to drive that consistent experience and help the customer convert as quickly as possible. Don't put the work on them, right? To go figure it out, to go figure out your navigation or to even do a search. Like it shouldn't be that difficult for the consumer to go ahead and, you know, learn more about the product, right? Buy with confidence and ultimately convert. And today, I think you're right. This disconnect between the experience and the ad creative and media is a persistent issue that's been there for a long time. And it's good to see that people are starting to turn more attention to it because it should have been a fundamental.
Yeah. And if you just think about time spent, it's also just a funny extreme where average time spent on an ad, 1 second. So,
yeah,
you know, if you think about that and how much you can do with that person at that time versus how much, at least let's talk about people who buy, how much time buyers spend on site. There's so much more engagement happening on site that if you're not spending the right amount of resources, similar to what I said before about spending the right amount of resources on creative versus media, same thing here between ad and site, right? People are only spending a second and a half on the ad. Your only goal of that ad is to get them to click the site. Why is there not an equal or greater focus on what happens when they reach the site?
Exactly. Well, Joe, we're taking quite a bit of your time, so I want to jump to the last question we ask every guest here on the podcast, and that is, what futuristic digital marketing or commerce technology or experience are you most looking forward to? Or alternatively, what do you think is overhyped and we should just stop talking about?
I'll go with the first one. I think it's part of our talk today, but I think there's a massive opportunity in brands really reshaping the way that they think about content creation. You know, we launched an entire subsidiary business around this called Breakfast. You can check it out at brkfst.io. And it's really a business that is built around this pain point that brands have of creating content at scale with variety and authenticity that performs. And I think that it's really challenging for brands to do that on their own. Like, how do you create 100 videos a month in a way that is platform right, that has a good hook in the first 1 to 2 seconds, that has a lot of variety? Like, it's really, really hard and or really, really expensive. And we built an entire business around that leverages a lot of software to do it. And I think it's one of the most exciting times to watch how brands are going to pivot, because this is a demonstrable change to how they allocate budget, to how they operate, to how they think about their brand guidelines. Like, it touches so many things that I think are going to be forced change over the next 12 to 24 months.
Well, Joe, thank you so much for all your insights and thoughts and for spending so much time with us here today. Really enjoyed the conversation. You can reach Joe at Within, the performance marketing company. and of course, we'll have links to how you can reach Joe on our podcast landing page. To all of you listening here today, thank you so much for your time as well. Be safe, be well, and here's to good business.
Thank you so much, Brian. Appreciate you having me.
You bet, Joe. Take care.